Hello, and welcome back to the DDI podcast, hashtag DDI discussions. On today's episode, we have Professor Shannon Valor, the first Bailey Gifford Chair of Data Ethics, discussing data, emerging technologies, and the human character during a pandemic. But first, make sure you subscribe to our newsletter at ddi.ac.uk and follow us on LinkedIn and on Twitter at Data Capital Ed. So sit back, relax, and enjoy the podcast.
Hello, I'm David Lee, and today I'm joined by Professor Shannon Valor, the first Bailey Gifford Chair in the Ethics of Data and Artificial Intelligence at the Edinburgh Futures Institute. She is also Director of the new Centre for Technomoral Futures at the Institute. So welcome, Professor Valor. You arrived in Edinburgh from Santa Clara University in early 2020. What made you decide to move from California to Scotland?
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. I had been living in Silicon Valley, teaching in Silicon Valley for over a decade. And I was someone who had been trained in philosophy, but as an applied ethicist that was working at the intersection of ethics and emerging technologies, I was spending as much or more of my time working with engineers, software developers, data scientists, machine learning researchers, as I was with philosophers and other academics in the humanities. And I'd been working for a long time at finding ways to bring data science, artificial intelligence, and other new technologies into conversation with ethics as a way of structuring good societies, as a way of determining what kinds of technologies are good to build and implement. And one of the frustrations I was running into was the way in which our educational systems have developed these ways of thinking about the future in complete separation and antagonism from one another. So humanities scholars are often trained to ignore what's happening in the technical sphere in their research. And technologists are often trained to exclude social and humanistic approaches in their work. And so what I was really finding was that was getting in the way of doing the work that really needs to happen around technology ethics. So I'd been looking for a way to get beyond this kind of mashing together of approaches that were really designed to be incompatible and not in conversation with one another, and find a way to tackle research in this area that would be truly collaborative and not just multidisciplinary, but interdisciplinary. So when I heard about the Edinburgh Futures Institute and the opportunity here for the Bailey Gifford Chair, it was really this remarkable moment, because as I read through the description of the Institute and its ethos and its aims, It was basically a description of what I had been wanting to exist and saying needed to exist for many years. And here it was being built and created. And not only that, there was an opportunity within it already to come and start thinking about data and artificial intelligence through the lens of ethics in a space where there would be these new multidisciplinary modes of teaching and research, of public engagement, not just staying within the confines of the academy. So it was that moment where I knew I had to make the move, because this was the opportunity that I had not known how to create on my own. And there was already this incredible institute being shaped around these ideas. The other thing that was attractive to me is, you know, as a philosopher who has for a long time been oriented towards a very kind of pragmatic and common sense approach to moral and other philosophy, I was really attracted to the way that the tradition in Scotland has been to really pursue these kinds of common sense philosophies that are integrated into the way society works and not as detached from the world as some philosophical traditions have been. So I had a sense that was confirmed by everything I learned later and since my arrival, that Edinburgh was the place for me to come and pursue the kind of work that I'd been wanting to do for a long time.
Okay, it sounds like the perfect job description. We can confirm at this point that Professor Vallo was not involved in writing that job description for herself.
I was not.
It was just a very happy circumstance. You talked about working at that kind of meeting point of ethics and kind of emerging technologies. What particularly concerned you over the last few years as technologies have emerged and taken a greater role in our lives about those kind of digital environments we've created and about that real, that way that technology is really starting to shape the way we live?
Yeah, I think a lot of concerns come from the fact that the way that digital environments are built have been focused on measuring things like user engagement, things like statistics on adoption and time spent in a particular application. And the metrics for success we have in developing digital environments really haven't been metrics that measure how well that environment facilitates the kind of communities that we want to exist in or support, or the kinds of democratic structures or kinds of communication and learning that we need in order to meet the challenges that are facing the human family. And so we have these digital environments that we built as supplements to our existing systems, but they became more successful than anyone imagined in taking over a lot of these spaces, replacing the traditional media economy, replacing the public square or other places where one might collaborate with one's fellow citizens to discuss challenges that face the community. And yet they weren't designed to perform these really robust and difficult civic functions or moral functions that a society has to manage. And so what we have then, for example, is a digital media system that's very good at generating clicks, that's very good at getting eyeballs to remain stuck to the screen, that's very good at getting people to keep scrolling through what promises to be an informative source, but really, as we've seen, often contains a growing and ever more confusing flood of truths mixed in with lies, conspiracy theories, rumors that are increasingly difficult to assess for their veracity, where the sources of that information and the motives behind it are increasingly obscured, and where the false and misleading information is in some ways exploiting features of our psychology that make them more successful than ever. And it's always been the case that falsehoods can spread faster than truth. But the digital environments have been designed unintentionally in some cases and intentionally in others to amplify those tendencies. And so I think we need to be able to think about digital spaces now, not as entertainments, not as supplements to our society, but as the infrastructure of our lives that needs to be built with as much care and moral and political intelligence as our democratic systems, as our systems of parliament or Congress or the communities that we build offline. So we need that political and moral wisdom that we recognize needs to govern the building of institutions outside the digital sphere. We need that amount of moral and political wisdom, maybe even more, to move into the digital sphere or the online sphere.
And how do we retain that kind of human element, Shannon, because it's easy to kind of follow this path of almost technological determinism, as I think you've sometimes called it, where technology leads and society follows. How do we get that human element back into how we shape that technology?
Yeah, well, I think partly is partly the answer to that is recognizing that technological determinism, which for those who aren't familiar with the term, as you said, means essentially that the future is shaped by changes in technology and society simply adapts or follows in the path of those technological advances. That's a fallacy. It's a mistake. It's not actually what happens, but it's a very convenient illusion to succumb to, because if technology leads and society follows, then we don't have to hold ourselves or one another accountable for where we're going. We just adapt, whether that adaptation is to something good or bad, whether we end up worse off or better off. Whereas the reality is that all technologies, including artificial intelligence, are human all the way down. These are systems or tools that are built to promote and optimize and systematize specific kinds of power and specific kinds of values in the world. And we are, humans are, and again, not all humans equally, but some humans have more power than others in this system to control the values that these technologies are amplifying. But ultimately, it's always humans behind these systems and their values. So we have to think of technologies not as something separate from society or separate from humanity, and then we have to figure out how to put the people or the humanity back into them. The humanity is already there. It's just disguised and not held accountable in many cases, and not recognized for what it is. So we need to begin to rethink of technologies as already reflections of specific human power structures, of specific human choices and values. And then we need to take accountability for those choices and those values, and whether or not they lead to outcomes that are just, that are sustainable, that are equitable, that are compatible with human flourishing and the flourishing of other forms of life on the planet. So that means getting away from this artificial split between technology and society. I used to teach a course called Science, Technology, and Society, and much of the course was spent talking about how the course title was inherently misleading, because it framed this as these are three separate things, and then we're going to talk about how they interact, when in fact there's no easy way to separate any of them. Science, technology, and society are all part of human structures of living. So technology doesn't live outside of our social world. It's always been. From the very earliest eras of human society, it's always been integral to how humans organize themselves and function. And today is no different.
And what about, if we talk more specifically about the internet, social media, this whole issue of this capacity for self-reflection, and how what has emerged, particularly in the social media world, is not allowing this capacity for self-reflection. And it's not necessarily allowing the kind of conversations that we would like to have, what you maybe talk about the public square earlier on. How has social media developed, and why have we not been able to get to this point where we can have a public square type debate there?
Yeah, well, it's complex. And obviously there are multiple reasons for that and multiple forces influencing the system and the way it functions. But I'll say two things. First of all, we have to recognize that our habits of communication and information sharing have evolved and been refined over thousands of years, but in an environment where the pace and scale of those communications was relatively stable over time. With some momentary disruptions, for example, the printing press was one of those, you know, transformative changes in the way humans communicate that had a number of disruptive social effects that had to be managed as well. But the digital sphere has, even more so than the printing press, changed the pace, scale, and structure of human communication in ways that we haven't had time to adapt to. So one struggle is we're dealing with systems that have not been refined over centuries or millennia to function the way we need them to, but systems that have just arrived on the doorstep and yet already have taken over in some ways the way we think and interact. So it shouldn't be surprising that we're having some struggles, to put it lightly, around aligning these systems with social well-being and stability. However, I want to come back to this point of self-reflection. What's really interesting about the ways that these digital spaces are organized today is that they encourage an outward focus and an outward direction of questioning. One of the nice things about the internet is it allows you to question authority in a way that was harder to do before, when communication was sort of from the top down. This bottom-up structure of digital communication allows anyone to challenge a leading scientist online, or a politician, or a leading media journalist. But we haven't given people the right online tools to question themselves or their own assumptions. And in fact, what the internet environment often does is overwhelm our faculties of critical thinking so that we fall back on more intuitive and emotional ways of reacting. So what I'm really interested in is whether there are ways to change the structures of the digital sphere so that we are encouraged not only to question and challenge other people's claims or experiences or stories, but to begin to turn inward and do the necessary self-reflection and self-questioning, looking at our own assumptions and our pictures of reality. Because right now, when we're on the internet, it's other people attacking our assumptions. It's always other people attacking our reality and our experiences. And so, of course, that produces this defensive reaction, right? Where I hold even more tightly to my view because in a social context, my status is tied up with the legitimacy of these beliefs, which represent who I am in this social space. And so if you're only challenged in that context, you learn to avoid having your beliefs challenged or taking those sorts of challenges seriously. And so we get into these reactive emotional modes. And this would be bad enough if this was just limiting our ability to critically reflect as individuals. But what it's ultimately doing is damaging our capacities for critical reflection as a society or in communities. And when we have immediate urgent challenges to confront, deep-seated challenges of economic or racial injustice, deep-seated challenges like the current pandemic, profound challenges associated with the threat of climate change, we cannot afford, with these challenges facing us, to be incapable of careful, critical reflection, including on our own background assumptions and beliefs. So we have to find a way to configure these digital spaces to make it possible to do what needs to be done in order to collaborate together, in order to cooperate, in order to exchange information in ways that leave us all better informed and better capable of prudent and wise action.
Yeah. And this has been a gradual change, obviously, but there have been some significant kind of points along the journey, if you like, Cambridge Analytica and so on. And what role has Donald Trump played all this? Has he come to kind of exemplify the kind of worst of what you've just talked about?
Unfortunately, I think it's hard to deny that's the case. I do think that it's a mistake to believe that Donald Trump somehow instigated our current, if you will, moral and intellectual immaturity online. I think these forces were already in play. This dynamic was already taking shape in 2016. And in fact, many critics of internet platform companies and others had already identified these trends and already begin to warn about the snowballing and destructive social effects that they could have. So I think when we look at Donald Trump, what we see is someone who has amplified this dynamic. He was the fuel that was poured on a fire that was already burning. And now it's exploded into an inferno. that seems to be accelerating. And it's easy then to look at the moment when that inferno bursts and attach it to one person. But I do think he's continuing to sustain this dynamic, unfortunately, because I think if you look at the patterns of his behavior on Twitter, you see that one of the effects that it has had is to undermine any notion of higher duties or standards that holders of public office have. I mean, there's no real difference in the tone or the content often between what Trump is tweeting at 2 a.m. and what a drunken, rage-filled teenager might be tweeting at 2 a.m. And that ultimately does undermine public trust in the structures of authority and leadership generally. So it has an unfortunate moral leveling effect that lowers the expectations for us all. And you see this often where people get sucked into this dynamic. They start off, you know, in a place of trying to sincerely engage with someone who disagrees with them. And at some point, the frustration boils over and people become their worst selves. And it's easier to do when you see the elected leaders of your society not exercising any self-restraint or self-editing or will to engage constructively, even when it's difficult. So I do think that while he is not the cause of what we are struggling through, he is in many ways perpetuating this destructive dynamic.
And do you see a sense, Shannon, of the tide turning? I mean, do you see a desire to approach technology in a more ethical, moral way? And, you know, did you start to see that during your time in Silicon Valley?
Absolutely. I think this is one of the things that's most exciting for me at the moment, is seeing that we're no longer able to pretend that these harms are insignificant or temporary. So as I said, you know, 5 or 10 years ago, many scholars were already identifying these dangers and the harms of online disinformation and the failures of technology to be designed to facilitate the kinds of civic spaces that were necessary in order for our institutions to keep functioning. But at the time, early on, the harms had not become visible enough for technologists themselves to recognize the urgency of meeting those challenges. And there was this belief that somehow things would naturally find an equilibrium, things would naturally settle down into a healthy state. And we now know that isn't necessarily going to happen. In fact, the evidence suggests that things might be spiraling out of control unless we act decisively to reform some of the more harmful aspects of digital culture. And so one of the things that I'm very excited about is how many technologists I have worked with and interact with every day who are profoundly motivated to this project of reform. I don't know that I've ever met someone, I know they exist, but I've never met someone personally who worked in the technology space who I believe didn't want the tools they were building to lead to better lives for people and better, healthier institutions. And I think there's a humility now in the culture of technology development that we didn't see 10 years ago. And that's a very healthy thing. And it's a humility that's still paired with optimism and still paired with a belief that we can do better. And so there's a lot more will to collaborate and cooperate with people who can bring the kind of social science and humanities perspectives that are needed to really build digital cultures that are robust and sustainable and healthy. There's a great will to do that that was not evident 5 or 10 years ago. So that's why I do think that the tide is turning. And I do think that this is a decisive moment in digital and technology cultures to decide what kinds of of online and offline worlds we want to live in. Because the important thing to recognize is we're past the point where there's online and offline as if these are two different spaces. These worlds interpenetrate and have functionally merged for large portions of people on the planet, and more every day. So we need to stop thinking about the online world as a sort of separate artifact. We need to start thinking of it as part of the social fabric that we have to care for.
And are we in time to turn the tide? And how optimistic or pessimistic are you about the future?
Well, I think we, as I said, I think we are in a decisive moment where there are challenges, sustainability challenges politically and environmentally, that are kind of like a ticking clock. So the clock is ticking ever faster to make these transformational changes to the way that that we engage with technology and society. We have to move very quickly to use our technological expertise and our moral expertise to remove the obstacles that are in front of us to a sustainable and flourishing future. So I would say the window of opportunity is there, but we can't expect that window to remain open indefinitely. And for many people on this planet, their opportunities to enjoy new or create new and better ways of life are already shrinking. So science and technology, in my view, should be unleashing human opportunities at every turn that allow us to be more sustainable and to flourish more successfully together. And in reality today, those opportunities are declining for a large share of the world's population. And that's a crisis. That's a crisis for humanity. It's a crisis for the legitimacy of science and technology as tools for human progress. So I think my goal my goal in shaping the mission of the new Center for Technomoral Futures that I'm going to be directing at the Edinburgh Futures Institute, my goal for that is to communicate the urgency of this project and to try to give people the data and the support and the resources to help tackle that. In terms of whether I'm optimistic, though, about the future, I get asked that a lot. And I've come to think that that's the wrong question, because that leads us to imagine that the future is already decided in some sense, that it's either going to be a good one or a bad one. And we're just trying to predict what that outcome is going to be, right? If you're an optimist, you predict that it will be a good outcome. If you're a pessimist, you predict that it will be a bad one. But I think that's the wrong perspective to take on the future. I think we have to ask ourselves, can we do what is necessary to make the future one that is worth wanting, one where we can flourish together in just and equitable ways in sustainable ways on this planet? And I think the answer to that is absolutely yes. We can do what is necessary, and we must do what is necessary. And I think the question of whether we will at this point isn't worth asking, because that's still up to us. And until the work is done, that future remains open and undecided. So I want to focus on the work that needs to be done and must be done, and not make a prediction about whether we will do it. Because I think that question is something we have to answer anew every day.
Professor Shannon Valla, thank you so much. Some fascinating insights there. Thank you very, very much for sharing them with us today.
Thank you so much, David.
If you enjoyed this podcast, make sure you hit review and check out ddi.ac.uk for a selection of upcoming podcasts and webinars and articles as part of our virtual engagement series, #DDI Discussions. Make sure you follow us on LinkedIn and on Twitter @DataCapitalEd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.